following is an account of a visitor who went to the herring fishery in 1895. The Fionnuala is a comparatively large smack of the lugger type, carrying two large lug sails, the main and the mizzen. Besides having on board the nets, she has a boiler and a small engine used for the hauling of the nets. 10 bunks affording sleeping accommodation for about 12 men. And finally, a very necessary item of equipment, a small fire for cooking purposes. The crew consists of the skipper, 5 sturdy sailors and a lad who fulfills the important duty of cook. After this respected person had returned from the shore, where he had been purchasing part of the night's provisions, viz. Bread and butter, the sails were hoisted, and on an ideal night, a day for sailing, with a fairly strong breeze from the northwest, we steered in a northerly direction from the Chicken's Light. After gliding round the breakwater, we passed the old castle, which shows ravages of the wind and sea. Soon the castle and the precipitous rocks forming a home and breeding ground for innumerable gulls which frequent this part of the coast are left behind, and sailing well up to the wind, we near the picturesque village of Port Erin. Tacking and steering in a westerly direction, Curran's Tower, the only landmark left to indicate the position of Peel, fades away in the distance and seems to break the spell which the beautiful scenery had cast over us. The cook announces that tea is ready, and we repair to the cabin to enjoy fresh herrings cooked in a manner to please the most fastidious appetite. After having had an enjoyable meal, we return on deck to find our course again altered and to learn we are in a fair way for the fishing grounds, which for this particular expedition lie about 5 miles beyond the Chicken's Light. Preparations are now made for getting out the nets. The mainsail is lowered and all unnecessary impediments cleared away. The net of the simplest kind, consisting of string netted in such a manner as to form meshes about half an inch square, being a little over a mile in length and 8 yards broad. To the nets are attached ropes at definite intervals, about 5 yards long. Some of these are attached to a stout rope, the same length as the net, and the intervening ones are fastened to the corks and the pigskin which floats on the surface of the water and support the nets during immersion. Consequently, there, when the net is set, it forms, so to speak, a wall a mile long, 8 yards deep, 4 yards below the surface of the water. The herring swimming along in the direction of the net find their way obstructed and endeavour to swim through the meshes, where they are held fast until released by willing hands of the sailors on board the smack. After the work of lowering the net has been completed, we partake of supper of cold boiled mutton and inhale the soothing vapours of the fragrant weed amid the calm surroundings of the summer night. At 10 o'clock, the skipper summons all the crew on deck, and there, under the blue canopy of the heavens, and surrounded by the wilderness of fluorescent waters, each man, on bended knee, offers prayer to his Maker. The crew then retire to rest, one man remaining on deck to keep watch. At the expiration of an hour, he arouses the next man in turn, and so on, until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, when the nets are hauled. I remained on deck until midnight, enjoying the novelty and beauty of the surroundings, then coiled myself up on a locker and fell asleep, to be awakened in the course of a couple of hours by the commotion on deck, indicating that the process of hauling the nets had begun. This is quite simple. The stout, strong rope is made fast to the windlass, the engine set in motion, and the nets, with any fish they may have caught, are gently guided into the hole. Shortly after 4 o'clock, the crew have almost finished hauling the nets. A grey streak became visible in the far east, heralding the break of day. At 5 o'clock, the clouds had disappeared and another day had well begun, with a turquoise blue sky giving promise of fine weather. During the turn sail of the early morning, the crew are busily engaged shaking their nets. At 6:30, the cook announces breakfast ready, and the crew attack lustily some of the newly caught fish. After entering the bay and passing slowly up the harbour to our anchorage, we return to the quay with the night's spoil. The herrings are sold to the highest bidder and are salted and packed on the quay to be sent to Douglas for curing. The loss of the Maggie Madrill Peel Lugger. Tragedy struck the Maggie Madrill while she was carrying her own herrings from Loch Nevis to Dublin on the 11th of December 1883. She was just abreast of the Iron Rock Lighthouse when she encountered the full force of the gale and immediately made for the Crinan Canal. Having lost her jibboom and foresail, she became unmanageable and was driven on the rocks south of Keel's Ferry. The crew comprised of W. Farragher, master, W. Collister and W. Farragher, seaman, and Joseph Gelling, 16. When she struck, the lad was first ashore, followed by Farragher, a nephew of the captain. The other two appeared to have lost their footing and to have fallen between the ill-fated vessel and the rock. The poor lad complained bitterly of the cold, and his companion boarded the vessel and took off some blankets at a great risk to himself. They then lay down in a cave until morning, having passed a dreadful night. They were found by a farmer, Mr. Fletcher, and his ploughman, who had observed the wreck. They were then taken to the farmhouse, but the poor lad soon succumbed. Farragher gradually improved. The seaman W. Collister and the lad Joseph Gelling were interred in a cemetery close to the scene of the disaster, but the captain's body was brought home in the Emma, one of his own boats, and buried in Peel Cemetery. The nets, rigging and cargo of the vessel was saved, but the vessel was a complete wreck. Probably too big for When the fishing was at its height, there were a tremendous lot of accidents at sea. This is one of the examples. This summer in autumn had been remarkable for exceptional weather, and on Wednesday there sprung up with terrible suddenness one of the fiercest gales experienced in Peel for many years. On Tuesday at midnight the weather freshened, and about 9 o'clock a full southerly gale was raging. About this time two nobbies, the Dinner Ken and the Bonnie Jane, which had been fishing all night, were seen trying to make for the harbour, but the wind suddenly veered to the southwestward and baffled the vessels in their attempt to gain safety. They were driven at high speed coastwards and disappeared in the heavy mist which prevailed at the time. Great anxiety was felt in the town, as it was feared they would be driven ashore. About 9:30, the lifeboat signals were fired, the boat being launched at 9:55. The wind was blowing from the southwest with almost cyclonic violence, accompanied with heavy rain. The lifeboat sped across the bay and in splendid fashion and reached the neighbourhood of the White Strand and searched about for the missing vessels, but without discovering any trace of them. The weather was so thick that the coxswain could not see any length ahead of him and put back to the bay seeking information. Word had meanwhile been thoughtfully sent in by Mr. Kermit Linyig to the effect that one of the vessels was at anchor off that place, some 3 miles from Peel. The Rocket Brigade, under Mr. William Kermit, which had been standing in readiness all the morning, with horses harnessed, set off at once for Linyig. Going across the shore road, they had a slight accident. One of the wheels came coming off. The men escaped without injury. This did not cause more than a moment's delay, and the cart proceeded on its errand. The lifeboat again set off, and reaching Linyig, found the Dinner Ken at anchor, with two masts down and some headsails gone. About half a mile from the shore, the mast asked the coxswain for assistance, and a rope was passed. and the lifeboat took the dinner can in tow. The dinner can was able to set her chief sail, and after a good deal of tacking in the teeth of a still strong wind, though much moderated, reached harbour about 3 o'clock. The Bonnie Jane, on the lifting of the fog, was seen further out to sea. She had worked well out into the wind, where she withstood all the very fierce gale, and upon the cessation of the wind, managed to safely reach Peel Harbour. The dinner ken was brought well into the bay, and sailed into the harbour by herself. The lifeboat went to the slip. Both vessels, as they came into port, were cheered by the anxious assembled crowds. Messrs. T.R. and H. Wood were on the quay at the time, very promptly and kindly made a collection for the lifeboat men, realising £3.07, making 5 and 2 pence for each man. The dinner ken is owned by Mr. Edward McMeekin, and was in charge of his son Robert. Another brother, Arthur, a man John Caesar Corris, and a boy named Cooley were also on board. We might say, but for the presence of the boy, the vessel would have been run ashore, which perhaps very little hazard of life to active growing persons, but the skipper very bravely declined running any risks for the boy's sake. They passed a fearful time, the boat an open one, shipping heavy seas, the men at times being up to their waist in water, and had hard work to keep her from sinking by bailing with buckets. When approached by the lifeboat, she was dragging anchor, and the crew had taken off oilskins and all heavy impedimenta, ready to spring shorewards when the vessel grounded. The Bonnie Jane is owned and captained by Mr. John Hall of Gordon. He had 3 others on board with him. The names of the lifeboat crew were John Wilson Coxswain, James Cow, John Quirk, John Sale, Robert McMeekin, John Kenyick, Thomas Shimon, John Christian, James Quilliam, John Kelly, Edward Kelly, and Thomas Gill. The circumstances prevailing at the time when the vessels were driven to sea were such that little hope was felt that they would ever again be seen, and it speaks well for the skill with which they were handled that they could successfully combat one of the fiercest gales remembered. The Bonnie Jane had the advantage of being the larger boat and fully decked, unlike the Dinner Ken, which is an older boat and almost entirely open. The seamanship must have been of the first order and worthy of the deservedly high reputation Peel fishermen enjoy in this respect. The conduct of the lifeboat was the admiration of all. She proved herself an able vessel, and when whatever call upon to do, responded admirably. Not that any adverse criticism, either at the handling by the crew or herself as a boat, was given by the competent critics who lined the shore, but all united in praises. This was the first real test of the Mayhew Medwin, and she gave unqualified satisfaction. Praise is also due to the Rocket Brigade, whose journey was dutifully undertaken, and who waited for hours ready for any emergency, only too willing to render help if necessary. It seems strange today that about 100 years ago, Peel had a fleet of schooners and smacks all around about 100 tons mark, which sailed the globe with cargoes. This was reflected through the eyes of an old salt who expressed his opinion in The Guardian in 1886. At that time, Peel men went everywhere. Regular wandering Jews they were. They could be found in the merchant navy or on board men of war in the service of their country. The old salts claimed that during that period the Peel men were the smartest men afloat, and that there were no such coasters as the Peel ones in the world. They knew every bit of the coast of Europe as well as they knew the gable. Not a rock or a shoal they didn't know, and they could find their way from port to port almost blindfolded. Peel fleet went up the straits to Malaga, Seville, and other places for fruit, etc., also to the Azores, Madeira, and North Africa. How well the boats did at that time is revealed in the fact that some paid for themselves in 2 or 3 years, when the fruit trade was in full swing. They also made heaps of money in the potato trade as well. It was known that the boats would clear £300 in one winter. Before steam came into its own, Peel craft would get freight when others were lying idle, as they were the fastest boats of their kind afloat. In 1850, the Smack Eclipse, 90 tons, left Glasgow and was moored up in Seville in under 7 days, and was back in Glasgow with a cargo aboard in 3 weeks. The same Smack also ran from Glasgow to the Rock of Lisbon in 4 days. Later, the Eclipse altered her rig and was made a schooner. The skipper was John Gill, better known as John Gill Nelly, and he was 6'3" tall. He and his brother Thomas were the best sailors the old salt knew. They could neither read nor write, but they could run a vessel by the chart on a dead reckoning with any sailor that ever commanded the ship, and they were never known to blunder. Both of them received their training at the John Gaunt School of Navigation, which was in Gaunt's Court alongside the Douglas Street car park. John was a wonder with the lister. No fisherman ever escaped him. He would take on board everything that came across him, conger eels, callig, and the swiftest fish in the water. He hurled a lister like a spear when the fish was out of reach and never failed to strike. He was known to strike it south in the Linghole from the top of the bank that used to be there. During the 1840s, there was a great flood in the river, and John was one with this lister. He struck an immense salmon when he was opposite the old Red Herring House, now engine shed in the railway station. But the fish was so big and strong, it twisted the lister right out of Gill's hand. The salmon went on up the river with the lister sticking in it, and John did not overtake it until he was opposite the mill. He rushed into the water and seized the lister, and after a terrific struggle, the monster was landed. It was found to weigh more than 60 pounds and was more than 5 feet long. No doubt one of the largest salmon ever caught in Peel River. John Gill died on the vessel he had sailed for many years. It was in Ramsgate during January 1865 when the crew saw that he did not appear in the morning. They broke into his cabin and found him dead. He had died in his sleep. They brought him home and he was buried in Patrick Churchyard. His son, who was also named John, also followed the sea as his calling. He was lost on the Zone in 1877. It left Stettin with a cargo of grain for England when it was caught in a terrific storm and was never heard of again. It was supposed that she went down in the North Sea with all hands. Thomas Gill was master of the Comet for many years. In 1852, the Comet left London for Bristol with a cargo of grain. She was caught in a storm, and her cargo must have shifted, and she went down in the English Channel, and all hands were lost. In the early part of the 19th century, Peel started building schooners up to 200 tons, many of which were operated by Peel crews. The largest vessels did foreign trade and the smaller ones home trade and coasting. It was not long before they became renowned for their seamanship and the speed of their vessels. One man can take a great deal of the credit for this, he being John Gaunt, who ran a school of navigation during the early part of the 19th century. During this period, any young men who intended making a career at sea attended this school. Although many could not read nor write, after attending this school, they could run a vessel by chart with any chart to any place with any sailor afloat. In the early part of the 19th century, Peel had many shipyards. One such was behind the old mathematical school in Market Street. It was William Cottier's. This yard specialised in the building of clippers, and built some of the finest and fastest boats of their kind afloat, such as the Kite, Ocean, Arrow, Hero, Friends, and Friendship. There was keen rivalry between the yards. For example, when the Ocean was being built in Cottier's Yard, the John and Samuel was being built by Charlie Farragut in King's Yard. She was launched the previous day to the regatta, and as time was short, she was taken into the bay where she was rigged and ballasted. She was good to sail, but the Ocean beat her, and this was immortalized by the following poem. The John and Samuel, the crooked boat, as on the Ocean she did float, she was rigged and ballasted in Peel Bay, and would have beat the Ocean with fair play. The John and Samuel was later struck by a thunderbolt whilst off Douglas Head, which set her in the water to her bows, splitting the mast, upsetting the stove, and scattering fire in all directions. Another yard was Corris's Yard in Athol Street, and they also had the largest tan yard on the island and produced the best kip and butt. In the shipyard they built Carna and Clipper boats, and these were called Corris's Big Boats, and in those days it was thought a favour to get a berth on one of them. Some of the better known ones were Morning Star, Active, Risk, and Neptune. There was not a carpenter in Peel who could build boats to quite the taste of John and Caesar, and old Conan had to be specially imported, and he introduced boats made to measure. Prior to this, all the boats in Peel were built by rule of thumb. The outsides were first made and then the ribs were put in. As proof of the high esteem these two enterprising brothers were held, the principal toast of the evening at boat suppers and club dinners was, John and Caesar live forever, the best of boats and the best of leather. The day for the launch of these clippers was looked forward to by men, women and children of the town as a gala day. On these days ale and rum was as free as water. Everyone knew when the launch would take place, and consequently there was no lack of help, as nearly all the inhabitants were there, either as workers or spectators. As a rule, the women were the best men on these occasions, the men generally having too much to drink, and it was on account of this that the saying, the women of Peel were the boys. Greased planks were laid on along the close and down the gill, Bridge Street, and onto the shore. A rope was passed around the bows, and the men and women applied themselves to it. So with a long pull, a strong pull, and a tremendous shout, the boat moved so gracefully down the gill as a swan glides over the water. Launches always took place at low water, and the boats were taken down to the low water mark, and it was floated when the tide came in. Due to the preparatory work for launchings from this yard, it was common for them to launch more than one boat, and on one occasion they launched four in one day. Probably one of the oldest buildings in Peel, three in Castle Street, under which there is a large vault. They were probably built during the 16th century, and early maps and pictures of this era show these three buildings and no other buildings on the quay. Originally, before there was any quay, a slipway ran from the vaults beneath them to the harbour. Little is known about their early history, but the first building was thought to be an inn, the second the officers' quarters, and the third the bishop's palace or townhouse. The vault stretches beneath the full length of the three buildings and extends further on. Probably the most important feature of the vaults is the herringbone building, and it is very similar in style to the crypt under the cathedral in Peel Castle. Some claim that the tunnel ran from here to Peel Castle. This tunnel is said had a number of chambers in it every so often, so that people could pass in it. There was what seems to be a tunnel facing the castle, but no one has been able to explore it, as it was always full of water. It is also claimed that these vaults were the centre of the smuggling activities in Peel during the period following the Revestment Act, and that from here there was a network of tunnels to various parts of Peel. I've spoken to a number of people who have played in these vaults in their youth, who have come across the entrances of the tunnels, and some have explored them. Two were exploring one day, and seeing daylight, found they were looking on Athol Place. Tunnels have also collapsed behind the Peel Castle Hotel and between Castle Street and St. Peter's Lane. A number of houses have double cellars. One was only recently discovered at the top of Castle Street. The fact that this building was made the customs house for a while probably bears out that this was the centre of smuggling. Robert Farrant, who was appointed first High Bailiff of Peel on 16th of September 1777, occupied this premises as the person responsible for customs under the Act of 1777. He removed to Ballymore, Derby in 1794. At that period there were three customs officers in Peel, as well as a boatman and a riding officer. No boats were allowed in during the hours of darkness, only in extreme emergency. There was a customs box at the point of the quay. There are many stories that can be told about these three buildings. The bottom one was known as the Parson's House, and it became the grammar or Latin school under the legacy of Philip Moore Senior Douglas, and latterly Ballymore Patrick of £500, and he died in 1846. The building was purchased by the trustees in 1770 from Philip Moore Jr. out of the accumulation of interest of the legacy, considerably enlarged and converted into a commodious dwelling house for the master, including a schoolroom. It is interesting to note that the only subject taught free in this school was Latin, and quarterage was generally paid for being taught English, etc. In 1826 there were 16 scholars. In some cases where families were unable to pay, the children did odd jobs for the schoolmaster. By an act of Tynwald in 1862, the trustees were authorised to sell this property and purchase a new site and build a schoolhouse and dwelling. The old premises were sold in 1863, but no new school premises were provided, and later the fund was incorporated with the Christian schools. Later, this building, which is above the main entrance to the vaults, became unoccupied, and the vaults became Dale's livery stables, the horses being brought down the steps on the quay side. Since the war, the building became a laundry and is now a foundry. The second house, after being the customs house, became a business premises and was occupied by a person named William Scarlett Littler in 1811. Later that year, Mr. Littler became associated with the Douglas Banking Co., but this was dissolved early in 1812. During that short time, they were in existence. They issued a number of silver tokens with a representation of Peel Castle on one side, and these became known as the Peel Castle tokens. These became valuable, and at a sale in Sotheby's, London, in December 1899, three Peel Castle tokens valued 5 shillings, 2 and 6 and a shilling, were sold for 50 guineas. By the 1820s, this building had become one of the 12 public houses in the big street, and was first known as the Caledonian Inn and later the Royal Oak, and became well known for its catering. It then became the Dale Home and provided homes for the poor. Prior to the Rifle Club taking it, the premises were unoccupied for many years. The third house became part of the Graves Empire in the 18th century and was known for a while as Mrs. Salmon's House, she being the widow of Henry Graves, who remarried. The ruins of old St. Peter's Church, standing on the marketplace, could never boast of beauty and grandeur of the Church of St. German, but reflects in its history and long and faithful service to the community. The date of its origin is lost in antiquity, like many of its records. Many stories and legends are told of its origin, one of which reflects the need of a church of much easier access than the Cathedral of St. German on St. Patrick's Isle. The story tells of a stormy day in Peel, and a visitor standing on the quay watching the turbulence of the sea as it broke over the rocks on St. Patrick's Isle, when he saw a funeral party approach and go on board a ferry. When the ferry was halfway across the harbour, a huge wave struck it, and the boat was overturned. All the people managed to scramble ashore, but the coffin was swept out to sea and never seen again. As a result of this, the gentleman gave the money for the church to be built in the town. The date when St. Peter's Church was originally built has been lost, but experts say it was probably built about 1550 as a chapel of ease to St. Germans Cathedral. The earliest dated memorial stone in the churchyard was 1595, and the first entry in the register is 1667. It would probably at this time have been made the parish church of the of Patrick and German, as the cathedral was then in a bad state of repair. In fact, in 1665, the wardens of St. German's Cathedral were put in the dungeon beneath the cathedral because they did not obtain a price for the repairs of the roof of the tower and chancel, the only portion covered at that time. After remaining in prison a week, they appealed against the decision, which they felt harsh, and eventually they were released on condition that they obtain the cost for carrying out the repairs. Feltham, in his tour of the Isle of Man in 1794, said the church was neatly pewed with carpeting within the communion rails. It was 27 yards long, the cross 19 yards 2 feet, and it had side galleries for public scholars. There was also a small ancient font. There was also a deep gallery over the west wing with outside steps, which was erected in 1710, and one of the ancient low arches was removed for this addition. It was during the year that, under an act of tumult, Patrick was relieved of all responsibility for the upkeep of St. Peter's Church. The two parishes were classified as one from the time of the old church of St. Patrick in the castle falling in a bad state of repair. And as the two churches were so close together, all used the same church and had the same vicar. The living of the vicar of Patrick and German was stated to be within the castle up to 1660. There were two inscriptions in the chancel, one to Captain Sylvester Ratcliffe of Knockgalo, buried December the 30th, 1731, aged 78 years. Two to Elizabeth Parr, Elias Qualtro, wife of Captain Caesar Parr, buried February the 20th, 1766, aged 29. There was one inscription in the church to John Lees of Ballylees, died at Knockgalo in Kirkpatrick, July 5th, 1784, aged 27. Services were held alternately in Manx and English, but prior to 1766, services in English were performed only once a month. One interesting headstone which still can be seen, Lieutenant James Mannering of St. John's, commander of HMS Ajax in the Battle of Trafalgar, Battle of Copenhagen, and the Battle of Nile. In 1816, extensive repairs and renovations were carried out to the church. Stained glass windows donated by Mrs. Crellin of Ramsey were installed in the east end of the church in 1872. At the same time, a tower was erected by public scription at a cost, including the installation of the windows, of £700. The tower was erected to house the clock given by Mr. J.K. Ward of Malty Hall, who was born in Peel. Once the new church became parish church, attendances dropped and the old church was closed for services and was only used as a Sunday school, Bible class, and for special services. In 1901, an attempt was made to make the church an undenominational meeting room, but this was not proceeded with. As the years passed by, the church gradually deteriorated through lack of use, although it took until 1958 to finally decide and have the building stripped, and now only the shell and tower are left.